My name is Debbie Steinerman. I am one of the organizers of this commemoration and co-curator with Marcy Scudder of the exhibit. This evening's commemoration, as you probably are aware by now, is in memory of the legacy of the late Elie Wiesel. Eliezer Elie Wiesel was a Romanian-born American Jewish author of more than 50 books, a professor, political activist, Nobel laureate, Holocaust survivor, and tireless advocate of the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust. Our featured speaker this evening is Ingrid Anderson, a former student of Elie Wiesel's and a lecturer at Boston University. She specializes in modern and contemporary Jewish theology, philosophy, and political thought. She currently teaches courses on post-Holocaust ethics, global Judaism, and the work of Elie Wiesel. Please welcome Ingrid Anderson.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank you on behalf of myself and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. And it's wonderful to honor my teacher here with you tonight. I thought a lot about what I wanted to talk with you about this evening. And one of the things that I've realized, especially since Professor Wiesel died, is that the Elie Wiesel that we had with us in the classroom was not the same Elie Wiesel that will sometimes appear in his texts. And I thought that I might share some of that with you, some of what that experience was like. And then I'd like to take any questions or hear any stories that you'd like to share as well. So when I came to BU as a graduate student, my plan was to study rabbinic era mysticism. And I knew very clearly that I wanted to get a PhD so that I could teach Jewish studies humanities courses to college students. I didn't know anything about Elie Wiesel. Mm-hmm. I had never read Night. I was told he knew a lot about Hasidut and offered good classes on the subject. And so it was in this capacity that I first studied with him. What struck me immediately was his ability to engage non-Jews in meaningful analysis of Jewish texts and ideas in a way that made them think deeply about and take ownership of their own traditions. During the years I studied with him, about half of Wiesel's students were non-Jews with very little knowledge of Judaism. I watched with great interest as Wiesel taught students unfamiliar with Judaism enough about Jewish history, life, and practice to understand what was so revolutionary about the Baal Shem Tov, and as though it were the easiest thing in the world, simultaneously offer more advanced discussions about content for those of us who were familiar with Jewish texts and traditions. In those early days as his student, I recognized, even before I came to love and value his work as a writer, theologian, and philosopher, that from the start, we shared a deep commitment to similar pedagogical goals, to identify, develop, and encourage student commitment to dialogue as transformative encounter, to provide students with the skills to understand and to be understood, even when this ambition was not immediately fulfilled. I watched as year after year, Wiesel's contagious enthusiasm about Judaism took hold of his students. And of course, for Wiesel himself, his Judaism was connected to, and even the source of, his desire for social justice, for dialogue with the other, for bystander prevention, and the celebration of particularity in general. I, too, believe in the power of Jewish studies, and perhaps cultural studies in general, to activate us, to encourage questions that have complex answers, or no answers at all, to explore the ways in which we can and should maintain our particular identities while remaining firmly invested in general society. Wiesel was a teacher of teachers. He certainly felt that his work as a teacher was by far the most important contribution of his career. He said repeatedly that he felt he would have become a teacher no matter what, that perhaps if it had not been for the Holocaust and its destruction of his home and the relocation it forced upon him, he might have stayed in Siget and taught Talmud, but he would have become a teacher. Instead, he taught the humanities in a Jewish key at Boston University. In recent years, the Elie Wiesel Center has begun to articulate what we feel his most important legacies have been for us. I have also come to understand anew the many gifts I received as his student. I recall that each year during the high holidays, Wissell would come into the classroom and tell the story that he told us in the film. When the trains came and took the Jews of his community away. And one of the things that I noticed each year was that you could almost see, as he was telling the story, his soul leave his body and walk out of the room, kind of a dissociation. And he could continue teaching anyway. And this was something that was really powerful for me. I think what, in that moment, I learned has stayed with me, which is that the traumas that we experience, they don't have to define us. They can actually make us stronger, and they can motivate us to make the world a better place. And that's what he taught me, among many other things. And I know that's something that he would like to share with all of you if he were here. So I currently teach Jewish Studies writing seminars at BU. Though I teach other Jewish Studies seminars each semester, I would like to discuss a seminar I began developing about 2 years ago, entitled Beyond Night, The Work of Elie Wiesel. In so doing, I'll share some of the ways in which I believe Jewish texts and traditions informed Wiesel's teaching. My hope is that by briefly exploring how the writing seminar Beyond Night attempts to teach Wiesel's work, that some of his pedagogy and the way in which it also is deeply informed by Jewish texts and traditions and concepts will be made clear. So in these seminars, scholars typically use their own areas of expertise to teach students not only content, but academic writing and research skills. Jewish Studies is well positioned to facilitate the teaching of academic writing and argumentation, creative but rigorous textual analysis, and perhaps more importantly, well-supported and passionate but respectful dialogue with people whose ideas may be radically different from yours. When students voluntarily enroll in Jewish Studies courses at BU, they do so for a variety of reasons. Some consider it an extension of their own Jewish practice, feel compelled to learn more about Judaism or Jewish theories and histories, or see it as an opportunity to learn about an unfamiliar faith tradition. Because these writing seminars are required for most BU undergraduates, students who might not otherwise take Jewish Studies courses are exposed to the field in engaging ways. But these seminars have to supply more than introductions to Judaism. They provide exposure to and promote familiarity with a variety of disciplines, introduce students to new aspects of history and political discourse, bring students into contact with challenging texts, films, and art forms, and provide meaningful opportunities to explore identity and identity formation, explode stereotypes, and create safe spaces for challenging but worthwhile intercultural dialogue. Although Wiesel never taught writing seminars himself, his method of teaching the humanities, in addition to the many educational elements of his work, can be successfully applied to teaching academic writing in the university classroom. So in the interest of time and clarity, I'll discuss three different aspects of his work, which I feel are evident and consistently applied in the classroom. Midrashic method, and you may be familiar with a lot of these, Chavruta study, and thought experiments in ethical problems. So the fundamental structures and principle of Midrash deeply inform my own teaching practice, and without a doubt, informed Wiesel's as well. Because rabbinic literature, in part, explores the ethical teachings of the biblical tradition and redacts oral teachings that both predate and exist alongside the Hebrew Bible, learning about and applying Midrashic method is useful in teaching invaluable transferable skills. For example, the rabbinic approach to working with texts and developing responsible and responsive argumentation is an excellent and enduring model for textual analysis, as well as the development of sustained dialogue around specific legal, social, and ethical concerns. Wiesel, too, approached the study of texts in this way and would refer to rabbinic texts and stories even in courses where none of the content he was teaching could be categorized as Jewish. In an effort to show students just how profoundly Judaism and Jewish educational methods inform Wiesel's thinking, we begin the Wiesel seminar that I teach with Souls on Fire, which is a collection of stories about the Hasidic tradition, beginning with the stories of the Baal Shem Tov. Students are surprised to find that they connect with and are moved by these stories, even if they know nothing about Judaism or Hasidut. It is precisely this fact that allows us to focus on learning about traditional Jewish approaches to education and textual analysis. Students unfamiliar with rabbinic literature tend to best understand this approach by envisioning it as, not unlike academic discourse, ongoing and unfinished, a conversation that began well before today and that will continue long after those currently engaged in it have perished. It is, in fact, again, like academic discourse, never ending. I sometimes encourage students to imagine a table at which tens or even hundreds of sages are seated for the purposes of completing, or at least beginning, a collaborative project for generations to come. Moreover, not all of the sages seated at this table are contemporaries. In fact, many of them are long dead, and yet their interlocutors continue to engage them, since their opinions must also be considered. They, too, are part of the conversation. And yet respectful engagement does not equal feigned agreement. The arguments are intense. The stakes are high. But opponents take one another seriously. Flippancy and cheap shots do not win battles. The urge to obliterate, or at the very least ignore, the opposing viewpoint must be among the first casualties in a good academic writing course. The fact that much of rabbinic literature is collaborative and that this collaborative structure is a reflection of traditional Jewish education is something that is sometimes difficult for students to picture in action. It is one thing to explore the relationships between teachers and students in Souls on Fire. It is another to imagine using that same approach to teaching and learning that the Rebbes and their Hasids use. The Chavruta study method is a powerful tool. It empowers students, but it also fosters learning relationships and promotes peer-to-peer learning and engagement. Chavruta-style learning, as students in Jewish day schools can attest, is intended to put each student in the position of analyzing texts and ideas and organizing his thoughts into logical arguments through the process of explaining his reasoning to his partner. I explain all this in these terms to point to the ways in which the skills needed by students of academic writing are the very skills these traditional Jewish forms of learning attempt to impart. Listening to, questioning, and interrogating your partner's ideas is as crucial to the process as sharpening your own thinking. As Rabbi Hanina once said, scholars who sit alone to study become stupid. Good Havrutas help you to keep one foot firmly planted in tradition and another pointed toward the future with an eye for innovation. Studying in isolation makes it all too easy to ignore or distort the opinions of others and remain safely ensconced in your own preconceived ideas. As I speak, you might be wondering how in the world does one utilize this approach to learning in a secular university for the purposes of a writing seminar? Good question. As a means of helping me to introduce them and then implement this approach to study, Rabbi Eliana Jacobovitz of B'nai B'rith in Somerville, also a former student of Elie Wiesel's, helped me to develop a workshop that we do with the students of my Wiesel seminar and any others who are interested, using a passage from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Shabbat 33b, followed by Wiesel's own commentary on the story from Sages and Dreamers. So I'm going to share some of that with you now, because I think when I think about honoring my teacher, this is one of the things I want to do, is to share these wonderful stories with you and his own readings of them and my own readings of them. So the workshop that we would normally do with these texts would, first of all, involve having the students choose someone to work with, and then Rabbi Eliana would say, all right, now just read this paragraph aloud to each other until you're in total agreement about what it means. Go. And they all just kind of, you know what? And she says, it has to be really loud because you're not learning anything unless it's loud. And then this kind of liberates them, especially the non-Jewish students for whom this is really a weird way to learn. And they're really surprised by how collaborative it is, and yet you have to agree. What does that mean? So it's a wonderful experience to watch them do that. Okay, so the story. For those of you who are not familiar with the story, Rabbi Shimon is forced to flee the Romans and hides with his son in a cave. So that's the setup to the story. This is from the tractate. They would strip their garments and sit up to their necks in sand. This is a description of what Rabbi Shimon and his son do all day when they're in the cave hiding from the Romans. The whole day they studied. When it was time for prayers, they robed, covered themselves, prayed, and then put off their garments again so that they should not wear out. Thus they dwelt 12 years in the cave. Then Elijah came and stood at the entrance to the cave and exclaimed, "Who will inform the son of Yochai that the emperor is dead and his decree annulled?" So they emerged. So out they come from the cave. Seeing a man plowing and sowing, they exclaimed, "They forsake life eternal and engage in life temporal. Whatever they cast their eyes upon was immediately burnt up." So imagine they're looking at the world around them and they're setting it on fire with their eyes. Thereupon, a heavenly echo came forth and cried out, "Have you emerged to destroy my world? Return to your cave." So God says, "Go back. You missed something." So they returned and dwelt there 12 months, saying, "The punishment of the wicked in Gehenna is limited to 12 months." A heavenly echo then came forth and said, "Go forth from your cave." Thus they issued. Wherever Rav Eliezer wounded, Rav Simeon healed. See, it said he to my son, said he to him, excuse me, "My son, you and I are sufficient for the world." So where the son still enters the world, the father is then capable of healing it behind him. Okay? I love that detail. On the eve of the Sabbath, before sunset, they saw an old man holding two bundles of myrtle running at twilight. "What are these for?" they asked him. "They are in honor of the Sabbath," he replied. "But one should suffice you?" And then he responds, the man responds, "One is for remember and one for observe." Said he to his son, "See how precious are the commandments to Israel." Thereat, their minds were tranquilized. Okay, so that's the end of the section of the tractate that the students read in the exercise. And then they read Wiesel's own interpretation of the story, which comes from Sages and Dreamers. And by reading through the lens of his own experiences, Wiesel arrives at an understanding of the passage's deeper meaning that supports, extends, and then augments the traditional interpretation of the story. And the sages of the Talmud really say that it's an illustration of the power of piety. And so Wiesel embraces this and then extends it. And I have the passage here from his text as well, from Sages and Dreamers. "Therein lay Rabbi Shimon's greatness. He had to go beyond suffering. The last year was probably the hardest. In order to rediscover compassion and understanding. Had he remained angry and bitter to the end, he would have been remembered with awe, not with love, and surely not in mystical legend. The last year made a different man out of him. It was a year beyond. Beyond suffering, beyond fear, beyond solitude. For suffering confers no privilege on anyone. It all depends on what one does with it. If it leads to resentment and revenge, it is doomed to remain weak and sterile. If it becomes an opening toward man, then it may turn into a strength." I want to repeat that. "If it becomes an opening toward man, then it may turn into strength." He understood the ambiguity of suffering. It pushes man to extremes and does not necessarily make him better. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Shimon had to endure far more than his master, for he survived his own ordeal. When he left his prison cave for the first time, he felt what our generation's survivors felt when they saw what happened, or that nothing happened, while they were away. Only then were they confronted with the real problem, what to do with their anger, their pain, and their despair. Like Rabbi Shimon, they could have destroyed creation, and like him, they chose not to. In Rabbi Shimon's later period, we come across most themes that haunt the Kabbalistic universe: the importance of the self, any person can save the world or destroy it, The ability, nay, the necessity, to transform curses into blessings, darkness into light. So those are my teacher's words. So back to my students. Their responses to this workshop are always animated. Many of them remark on the unique challenges of studying a text aloud with a partner whose job it is to add as well as to test the limits of their own understanding of the material. And yet, they tend to feel excited by this challenge. In a very literal way, the workshop helps them to understand Wiesel's own thinking, of course. But it also provides experiential learning for them, and we discuss at length how Wiesel is reading the rabbinic text in an innovative way without violating either the original text itself or the traditional rabbinic understanding of it. How does he interpret a word here and a phrase there in a way that allows for this new reading? And so then in closing the workshop, we provide our own commentaries to and interpretations of Wiesel's reading of the original passage. And they leave the seminar with the greater experiential knowledge of Midrashic method and the benefits of dialogical learning. And one of the things that Professor Wiesel said a lot is that as long as we're talking, it's a lot harder to hit each other. So let's keep talking. And this is what they try to do, keep talking. But the ideas we explore do give rise to transferable skills, close readings, responsible but innovative argumentation, and then, most importantly, perhaps, the ability to work collaboratively. And so the last tool I want to discuss today is one referred to earlier as thought experiments in ethics and ethical problems. And this is, I think, so central not only to Wiesel's writing, but to the work that he did in the classroom with us. This is one that students often use themselves, whether they know it or not, as they engage with materials, and it's perhaps the staple in the humanities classroom. And it's sort of the idea behind, you know, why reading Shakespeare makes you a better person, all those things that humanities scholars like to say. Certainly, Wiesel taught literature as a tool for fostering ethical engagement, so as early as 1975, he insisted that literature should, quote, become an aspiration to and for morality. And so while I think that Wiesel certainly meant that literature could and should be used to disseminate moral messages, I believe he also felt that literary fiction had additional practical applications in the classroom and beyond. So reading fiction allows us to use and explore ethical problems that we might not face in our day-to-day lives, and think carefully about how we might to respond to similar ethical dilemmas. It allows insight into the thoughts and feelings of others in a way that fosters cognitive empathy or perspective taking. And I think this was really key for him. When we experience cognitive empathy for others, we can know what others are feeling and what they might be thinking. Cognitive empathy, arguably the first stage toward the development of compassion, and that's the goal, right? Compassion. Can lead to the development of emotional empathy, wherein you feel as though you are too feeling what the other feels, as though it were contagious in a way. So this kind of empathy allows us to be in tune with the feelings of others, but the most valuable kind of empathy is, again, compassion, which not only allows us to understand a person's feelings and feel with them, but also, most importantly, respond simultaneously to help others if needed. This is the process Wiesel believed can and should be activated and nurtured by literature. So just in closing, I'd like to say that Wiesel insisted that writing about the ideas of others help us to understand ourselves more deeply, and at the same time that writing well can enable us to command the understanding of others, which is what he spent his life doing. When these concepts are taught in conjunction with part and parcel with the examination of Jewish studies content, they can truly help students think critically about the world and their place in it long after they leave the classroom. So another thing I wanted to share with you before we hear what you have to say, questions, comments, ideas, is that I think the one thing that is missing from the writing of Elie Wiesel, and I was thinking especially watching the film, it's missing from that as well, is his love of laughter. He absolutely loved to laugh, and he told jokes every class period. And I thought about this even more. I teach a class called Ethics After Auschwitz, and it's thinking about the problem of ethics since the Holocaust, and we also look at the history of various other genocides. And I was realizing that myself and my students in my classroom, we laugh every day a lot. And my students will say, you know, my roommate says, God, that must be such a depressing class. And they go, God, it's so awesome. We laugh all the time. And I thought, okay, I know where I got that. And that was something, you know, he loved to make us laugh. He told us funny stories about the Bible, about the Talmud, about his life leaving the DP camps. I mean, he was really incredible in that way. And so I think this work is so important for us to do, remembering and telling stories and testifying, but it's also really important for us to laugh together. I think that's something that Wiesel really wanted to impart to us. So thank you for having me. And I hope if there are any questions or comments. Yes.
Hi, thank you. Did it come up in class how Elie Wiesel dealt with Holocaust deniers? And do you still find that that's a topic that you have in your own class? Had any students ever come to class with the thought that the Holocaust was a hoax, and then you convinced them, or Elie Wiesel convinced them otherwise?
That's a great question. So yes, for those of you who might not know, Elie Wiesel basically just refused to engage with deniers. He just said, I'm not going to have to prove a historical fact. Just not going to do that. As a graduate student, I worked in his office and went through a lot of the mail and, you know, filed it, and I was shocked at how many letters we received of people really claiming that either he wasn't really a survivor, or that that it didn't really happen the way everyone thought it did. And I don't remember that in his classroom anyone ever, you know, even hinted toward Holocaust denial. Also the same with my students. It's more the reverse, that they're not aware that there is such a thing. And so then we talk about tools for dealing with that. And I think, has anyone seen the film Denial?
Yes.
Okay, I really recommend it. It's the story of Deborah Lipstadt, who is a professor at Emory and specializes in Holocaust denial. And it's really her, a story of her journey in dealing with Holocaust deniers. And so I think this is the approach that I tend to take, I think, is not to engage by sort of trying to prove that the Holocaust happened, because, you know, it did. Rather, it's to prove that their arguments are flawed. You know, if they're going to come at it like a historical event, get out of the way. Because, you know, they don't know what they're talking about, and you can collapse their castle pretty quickly. That's a really great question.
So you've demonstrated nicely how to use Jewish methods of study to develop critical thinking. But if you don't mind, if I ask, you know, how did you know that? How did you come to that journey yourself?
To working with traditional Jewish study methods?
Yeah.
Through my training at BU. Yeah, I mean, so I became interested in Jewish studies as a young person. And then once I had to decide what to do for graduate school, I just Jewish studies. And for me, I think I found those methods so meaningful and so helpful. And really, they just informed my own teaching and thinking before I could even make the decision. I mean, it just was very natural to me. And then once Wiesel retired and we began to think more, we meaning former students, more carefully about what our legacy was, I realized that that was a big part of it.
Thank you, Professor, and thanks for illuminating a whole area of Wiesel's scholarship that I had no idea existed, and it's very valuable. What would Elie Wiesel say now regarding cognitive empathy and what's happening on a lot of American campuses and what's seeming to be a total collapse of any attempt at, you know, the other has to be pulverized rather than engaged?
Oh, I think he would be heartbroken.
How would he counter that?
He would just keep doing what he did. Don't think he would have done it differently. I think one of the things that I felt very powerfully in his later years. So I studied with him really near the end of his career at BU. He sometimes would doubt if he did what he meant to do. You know, did I really have the impact that I thought I did? Did I do enough? Did I tell the story well enough? And I think he would probably be feeling a lot of that. In some ways, I feel grateful that he passed away in the summer and missed the whole, you know, dawn of where we are now. I think he would remain really active and would do the kinds of things that we're doing here.
Is that a real phenomenon that's happening? Or we're just hearing about isolated examples of this at Berkeley and Middlebury. Is that representative of a real trend, or is it just something that's very dramatic in the news media?
You mean the increase of white power and anti-Semitism?
Well, certainly anti-Semitism, but mm-hmm. this total shutdown of any conservative or thing that doesn't fit a certain category. Is that really a trend, or is it just an isolated...
I think it depends on the institution. I know at Boston University we do have quite a few conservative faculty and their conservative students, but those conservative faculty and students don't tend to shut down dialogue either.
Yeah.
So I think it really depends on where one is. You know, I know that in places like Berkeley, it's likely to be, you know, I think people are scared. And I think it is really hard to talk with one another. And I think that would be, you know, I'm just reminded, you saying that, I'm remembering the Bitburg affair with Sal, you know, when Ronald Reagan went to, you know, the cemetery in Bitburg, and he just desperately tried to engage with Reagan. It didn't work, but he kept trying. And I think that's just what we have to do. I really think we have to try to understand each other no matter how hard it is.
Hi. So thank you very much for sharing your experiences and the stories of Dr. Wiesel so we could have that connection. There have been a couple of questions in my head recently, but relevant to this conversation. I was speaking with a friend recently, and we both grew up... came of age in the latter 70s, early 80s, and I can remember growing up in a big city in Cleveland, and just there was an intense period of time where in my early teens I read tons about the Holocaust, and it was just part of our upbringing. And, you know, there was parts of town where you could go and, you know, you could see people working and you could see numbers on their arms.
Right.
So as we go forward, my friend was speaking of his daughter, who's 13 and is growing up in Essex County, New York. So more rural, perhaps, maybe one of the few Jewish kids in her class or whatever. And he spoke of her own education being so different from his own experience. You know, that she hasn't received... the Holocaust isn't foremost in her mind. She doesn't have interactions with people who... So going forward, how do we, as we move around the world, maybe in places where there are not as many people familiar with the story and as more survivors are no longer with us, how do we share that knowledge? How do we educate others? And how do we keep it going?
That's a great question. So one of the things that Professor Wiesel often said to us is, I'm so sorry to have given you this burden, but now it's yours. And I, you know, at the time we all thought, what's there to be sorry for? And now I'm like, whoa, yeah, it's heavy. But it's also, I mean, I see with my own students, you know, just a few weeks ago, we were commemorating the 70th anniversary of the doctor's trial, the Nuremberg trial. And I looked around the room and I saw students of mine from 5, 6, 7 years ago who had come to the event, people who didn't study, who didn't major in Jewish studies or Holocaust studies. So I've given them the burden, and now they're taking it. So that's one way. I think we really just have to talk to each other and engage and share what we know. I think on a sort of, on an institutional level, I know that a lot of my own students have done research on Holocaust education in the United States, and it's not actually mandatory in very many states at all. And even where it is mandatory, the people who are given the job to teach Holocaust history and genocide history and education don't necessarily have training in that. So in other words, they may say to the literature teacher, okay, you've got to do the Holocaust unit, and you know your students are going to read Night, and you can teach the Holocaust through that. Well, first of all, you can't, it's not really possible to teach the history of the Holocaust through a memoir, you know, written by one person. And it's also not fair because this literature teacher is probably not trained to do any of that. So I think one thing that is really important is for us to continue to advocate for that kind of education as part of public schools, not just Jewish day schools, not just private schools who, you know, in liberal parts of the country, like, you know, Massachusetts or Vermont. So that's one thing. I also think that even the students who come to my classes with knowledge of Holocaust history, you know, they know how many Jews, they know the names of the death camps, they know all those things, but they don't know the pre and the post. So they don't know how did Germany get there. I mean, I wish I had a dollar for every time somebody said, why did Hitler hate Jews so much? And I always go, okay. So when the Romans came to Europe, you know, it's like you have to really start them there. And I have to say, I'm sorry, got to take you back that far. That is really the kind of education that needs to happen too, so that they know what are the red flags. You know, what are things that we can see in a society that has the danger of becoming genocidal, and then for societies that have become genocidal, how do they change that? How do they heal from it? So I think, I don't know if that really answers your question. I do think that we will miss that not having the survivors there to physically tell their stories to people will make a big difference, but I think we can still do it. I think we have to.
Thank you, Dr. Henderson, for being here.
My pleasure.
I have a comment and then a challenge to all of us. I'm going to try to keep this out here so it doesn't reverberate. I took a number of Jewish studies courses in my undergraduate years because I love religion. And as Jay Coggs knows, I love them. And so I make myself known over here as often as I absolutely can.
Love you too.
Thank you. Thank
yes.
you, Rabbi.
Yes, see, and this is the kind of stuff that makes a difference too.
And I remember a joke, and you'll excuse me, it has truth, but it's a challenge. The difference between Jews and Christians, when the rabbis get together and disagree, they fight and they talk and they raise their voices and it gets loud and crazy. Christians separate and build a church across the street. And I've always...
Synagogues.
Synagogues as well, certainly. And I'm... As a Christian, I find it an amazing commentary, obviously in a joke, of truth. My denomination has seen it very recently over the issue of gays and lesbians and homosexuality. We saw it not far before that about women and orders. So, and all we did was split.
Right.
And voices became silent. And so your conversation about what it means to stay in relationship is deeply powerful to me.
Yeah.
So thank you. And secondly, my call to those of us who are here, it's so beautiful to see so many of you here. To give you a little background, about a month ago, the Greater Stowe Interfaith Coalition had a panel discussion on diversity in Stowe and in our community. Mm-hmm. Stowe looks very white, so we often like to think that there isn't. And we had a beautiful conversation. My call to us is to continue this conversation about what does it mean that we can draw from one of our representatives to grow. I mean, you kept saying to us, this is what the Jewish world can offer. Well, let's take them up on it. Plain and simply, what a gift. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.